Org/everywhere.
Good afternoon. Welcome. This is The Third Opinion. Two Jews, three opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And we are glad you're with us today. Let's take the music down here. We got the music way too loud.
We do, but we've got an interesting show. I mean, a lot of, I think some important conversations to have today on the limitations on criticism of the Palestinian Authority, as well as the Hamas government. So there was a Palestinian activist who actually lives in Washington, D.C. right now. He went to university school here. His name is Fadi Esselmin. He's 35 years old. And he had a very active account on I believe it was Facebook. He had almost 1 million followers. And on this page, he was very critical of the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, and just raised a lot of questions about the welfare of the Palestinian people under the hand of the government. And for whatever reason, and I'm glad that he's protesting it, Facebook took his page down.
Which is incredible to me, because Facebook allows all sorts of false narratives to go on, and says it's not going to censor that narrative at all.
Right. And we see, but you know, it's really interesting because we talked about last week the censorship of Paw Watch on YouTube, which was showing these videos of what happens within Gaza by Hamas and the training of these children, what they're doing, and they took it down saying it's too violent. And now you have Facebook taking down an active critic, a Palestinian actively who can't, he was born and raised in a small village just outside of Hebron. Criticizing the Palestinian leadership. And so this issue of censorship is important because we see this playing out in some more
articles. Well, I mean, obviously, Hamas and Abbas cannot take or will not allow any criticism of what they're doing. And
it's illegal, actually. Yeah. So in the Palestinian Authority, they will freeze your bank accounts. It's illegal. So it's just people. So when you think about the idea of free press doesn't exist there, right? I mean,
right.
How can you criticize? And this raises, and so you ask this question of these false narratives that we see so much of, and really the reconstruction of history that's been going on for the last 20, 30 years. And this is why. Yeah, I mean, so if you try to attack it, they're going to go after you. So I thought there was another piece that came out that was really related to this. It's by a think tank. What is it? It's Gates One or Gates Tone, or Gate Tone Institute.
This is the one that what Palestinians are concerned about?
Right. So there was a nice piece done by them, this think tank, about the crackdown by both the Hamas government as well as President Abbas, the Fatah government, cracking down and arresting journalists. They're afraid of their own Arab Spring, because if you remember last spring, there were protests within Gaza. Many were protesting the Hamas rule and government and protesting the unemployment issues and protesting so much of what the government was doing as far as the corruption and the misspending of funds. And, you know, this goes back to all the issues we're always trying to talk about that people ignore. They always want to point the finger at Israel. I'm going, hold on. The Palestinian people themselves are protesting their government.
Oh, yeah.
They're getting cracked down. They're getting arrested and massive crackdowns. And we see it happening now again because I guess in the face of what's going on in Lebanon, they're afraid of their own Arab Spring and more and the people rising up against their corrupt governments.
Hani Al-Masari, who is a prominent Palestinian political analyst, says the ruling Palestinian elite is mostly corrupt and tyrannical. I thought that was great. With the exception of a few, the elite is corrupt and incompetent,
right,
or both, he says. And there's more and more of that coming out. As we talk about a peace process, the people, it seems, want peace, want a solution.
Of course.
And Hamas and Abbas they don't. They sound like a group there, Hamas and Abbas.
Fatah, it doesn't matter. Like, both governments, whether you're talking about the West Bank or talking about Gaza, are just so corrupt, and the money doesn't go to the people. And so, you know, you see it. So Hamas this week, the security forces arrested dozens of Palestinian activists.
And journalists.
And then specifically two journalists, Hani Al-Aqa and Bassam Mohsin. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing this, but I think it's Mohsin. Were arrested for posting critical comments against Hamas on social media. And then the Palestinian Authority did the same thing. So you see the Palestinian Authority then making arrests against journalists and security forces. Was it Mahmoud Abu El Hassan and Radwan Kwat Anani? I hope I didn't mispronounce it. I apologize if I mispronounce these names. But you see them doing this because they are raising, again, the nature of the charges against these journalists where they claimed it was for security reasons because they were criticizing the government. And then Hamas, I think there was another, Hamas ended up arresting one of their own officers this week, Hussein Qatush, because he posted a video on Facebook complaining about the dire situation in the Gaza Strip related to the economic conditions. By the way, not blaming Israel, blaming Hamas. And so, you know, you have a member of Hamas's own ruling party complaining about this. And of course, he's now getting arrested. So this goes to the fact that there's no free speech. There's no right to criticize.
Although I must say in this country, some people of the current administration, with their labeling fake news, any news they don't like, is one step away from trying to destroy the free press. They haven't arrested journalists, obviously, and happily. But no. They label fake news anything they don't like. Fake news is not truth that the administration doesn't like. Fake news is news that's not true. And anything that the administration doesn't like, fake news is the label it's put on it.
I don't want to have a conversation about the U.S. government.
Lorraine, it's significant if we're criticizing the Palestinians.
There is no comparison. I mean, I'm talking about the fact that you have reconstruction of history by the Palestinian leadership for 30-plus years of Jews living in that area for thousands of years consistently about not being able to criticize your government, being arrested for crackdowns on protests by people, which is the narrative that you hear.
As a journalist, I am concerned. I am concerned that we are not far from that in this country.
I think knowing what the Palestinian Authority has done, I think we're very far from that in this country. And thank God we have elections, and every 4 years we can vote for a new president and do different things. And we have Congress. We have over 500 members of Congress that actually make most of this decision. And we have a Constitution, and we have a First Amendment, and we have a Supreme Court. So I don't worry about those things because we actually have the ability to protest. We have the right of protest.
Right now, absolutely.
And it's not going away. Here, you have no right to protest. So I got to strongly disagree with you, Mike. I don't want to, because I think what that does is it whitewashes what's happening over there.
No. I'm not condoning what they're doing over there,
I don't want to de-minimize it, though. I think making some type of comparison between the two is not. I mean, the press do not get arrested here. I can go on social media and say anything I want. I can, as do millions of people every day, and we're not being cracked down and arrested. I think this is a different situation. So I don't want to whitewash that, because this goes to the point of we're constantly getting callers and emails from people attacking us and, you know, always blaming Israel and thinking that we're dead wrong. But I'm like, listen, you never want to hold the leadership accountable, and the Palestinian people, their own people, are like, help us.
I agree. We'll just have to disagree.
Right.
Because I feel strongly. And
I know, because you're a member of the First
Amendment Foundation.
Right.
And I see things closing in. This gets way off base. But even in the state of Florida, people who have filed protests have been sued to shut them down from talking. Janet Reno's sister is currently facing a $4 million judgment for protesting about an agency in South Florida with water management. Now, you know, she wasn't arrested, but everything was taken from her. Everything, her little kayak, they came and confiscated from her. This is Janet Reno's sister.
Right. Okay. Well, no, we're off.
Okay.
Because there was another really important piece that came out today. So let me just. It's called. It's this. The it was a.
was this in Haaretz? This was in the Israeli paper, I think Haaretz. It's in their Haaretz magazine. I don't know why it doesn't say it here, but and it's titled How an Israeli Arab Psychologist Became Germany's Staunchest Islam Critic. And it's a great piece on Ahmad Mansour, who's born as an Israeli Arab, now lives in Germany. And what he does, and it's a great, if you have time, I'm going to strongly encourage our listeners to read this article. He goes through a lot of the problems that he sees within Islam and just the idea of this radicalization, but that radicalization sort of ignores what's really happening to the Palestinian people and detracts from real criticism of what's happening to these people. And he's the first, by the way, he's the first Muslim to win Israel's Theodor Lessing Prize. And when he received that award, he said, this is his quote. He says, where anti-Semitism rules, democracy dies. And he is a staunch fighter against anti-Semitism, in particular anti-Semitism in the Muslim and the Arab world. And I thought this was really just something so extraordinary. And he criticized the comparison of the Palestinian plight, for instance, to the Holocaust. He says, and this is a quote from the article, he says, I don't want to compare the two situations. It's something political Islam tries to do all the time. To say our situation is like that of the Jews before or during the Holocaust is a victimization strategy they always use. There was no Muslim Holocaust here, nor will there be any. And obviously, right, that world is predominantly Muslim, not all Arab, but predominantly Muslim, whether we're talking about Northern Africa, the Middle East, the Balkan states. All of which, by the way, people forget, these were the Mizrahi Jews who had lived there for hundreds, if not sometimes thousands of years, who were expelled from all of those countries. Most of them were refugees who came to Israel in the early 1900s because of the expulsion from those countries. But I just thought this was such a nice critical piece. He's a critical thinker, and it just makes you think about things maybe a little differently.
Right, but I think that what we don't want to do with a broad brush is say everything about Islam is wrong.
Oh, no, not at all.
No, but that's the impression some can come away with. It's the radicalized version
and he talks about it. He talks about how he was drawn into it as a young boy. All of a sudden, he had these friends, and he said what was really bothering to him, and what upsets him the most about the community is sort of the ambivalence to the violence. Like there was a comment that he made here during the Second Intifada. He said, "I remember people from the Islamic movement telling us it's not okay what they did, meaning these men who I think they were jihadists who had murdered three boys." He said, "But they will go to heaven." He goes, "If you can imagine the conflict that would create in a 15-year-old boy at the age of 15, and the struggle with that ambivalence." But I think he's a critical thinker, and it's not an attack on the religion, because obviously there are wonderful people in the religion, but then there are others who abuse it for the purpose of this political attack and for violence. And look, it's no different than the Crusaders using it, and you see throughout history, people use religion for different purposes. But I think that that's a really important piece as we're addressing these other issues of Palestinian leadership and being critical of the government and taking the time to think about, if you say you really do care about the Palestinian people, you need to take the time to read these pieces. You need to take the time to think about it and not always point the finger at Israel and say everything
Absolutely.
Is Israel's fault.
Why don't we do that? This is really, really out of format. We're waiting for our guests, but we've got some calls on the line. We can then come back to News for Jews later. Is that okay with you? We don't plan these things out. We've got David from California who is with us right now.
Oh, okay.
We just sort of roll with the punches. David, you're on the air.
Oh, morning. I was, I guess afternoon for you.
Right.
Hey, I was lucky enough to be raised in a thing called the Ethical Society, and that was, it was actually, strangely enough, put together by a combination of Jews and Christians, and they, if you remember what the Moors were like, they were like living in peace and prosperity for 700 years. 700 years of peace and prosperity, the Moors, the mixture of Muslims, Christians, and Jews living in Spain. The Catholic Church was furious. They were so jealous. and they just tried to destroy it, and they took 700 years to bring it down. So it's this idea that we're trapped in some old boy propaganda, and it's actually destroying the planet. You know, we're seeing the global warming is getting worse because of wars and oil usage and fighting over natural resources, and then they're now spinning it into religions, like Betsy DeVos and her what's a Dominionist idea of Christianity, where you don't have to be a steward of the earth if you're a polluter. And so, you know, the Koch brothers love that kind of stuff. So I was just looking at, you know, Palestine and the propaganda about it. Look at it in terms of who's sitting on whose real estate and who's trying to, divide and conquer.
Well, you know, your call leads us into our special guest today. So I hope you'll listen as our guest is with us on the phone. Lorene, you want to introduce Sean? I'm sorry. I'm throwing it on.
We do have a special guest on the air with us. The organization is called CAMRA. And what I love about CAMRA, it really focuses on a lot of the false narratives in the press, in the media, in particular as it deals with Israel and reporting in the Middle East. Sean is a senior research analyst for CAMRA in Washington, D.C. The organization itself is 65,000 members strong. It's Boston-based. It stands for Committee for Accuracy and Middle East Reporting. He has appeared on a multitude of media sites and has written for many. He's appeared on Fox News, the Baltimore Sun, the Washington Examiner, the Washington Times, the Jerusalem Post. And he has a master's in diplomatic history from the London School of Economics. And we're really excited to have him with him because I watch this all the time. You know, we're talking about sort of a lot of these false narratives that we see in the media, not only here in the U.S., but really the BBC globally and Europe in particular. As it concerns Israel and the Middle East. And so with that, welcome, Sean.
Sean Derns. Welcome. Sean, you with us?
I sure am. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you. There is so much false reporting. We were talking about fake news before, but there's so much that comes out through the Middle East. How do you guys go about fact-checking everything that comes across your desk?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question there, Mike. So we have an excellent website, www.camera.org, which is kind of a repository for a lot of information that we've accumulated over the years. And we have a team of analysts that are very well versed in the subject. We have dozens of books, and we're basically subject matter experts when it comes to the conflict and related issues. So that's one, the repository of knowledge that we have allows us really to work with reporters, work with editors, and to make sure that that the facts are right, because oftentimes they're not.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, you know, I get your email, your regular email, and I see a lot of the issues come up in Europe for the most part. We see a lot of the false narrative, even as it concerns, for instance, the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn and his anti-Semitism. But we see this a lot. And I saw it in particular during conflicts. You know, we saw it in 2014 during Operation Protective Edge. We've seen it during the knifing attacks. We've seen it during the protests on the border between Gaza and Israel. You know, why don't you, if you could, take a few minutes and maybe explain or, you know, sort of discuss two or three key instances that you can recall of some of this false narrative that you saw and how CAMRA was able to address it and correct it.
Absolutely. So as you noted, Lorene, there's really many false narratives that surround the conflict, and they're propagated throughout the world. Certainly in Europe, they're quite bad. We have affiliate sites, UK Media Watch and BBC Watch, which deal with a lot of the major European outlets. And there's been a variety of narratives that kind of crop up and are usually pushed by the media, often thoughtlessly. So one thing that we saw, for example, was during the so-called Return March in the spring of 2018, where you had a bunch of Palestinians in an event controlled by Hamas trying to go through the Gaza-Israel border. Many of them were armed, and they had terrorists interspersed along with civilians. So Israel warned them, tried to do everything they could, used gas and other measures to prevent them from breaking into Israel's sovereign territory. And unfortunately, several people were killed. And the way this was reported in the media was that these were simply protesters.
Right. It was peaceful protesters, right.
Right. In fact, up to 80% of them were linked to terrorist groups. 80% of those that were killed. That was almost not reported at all in the media. So that's one recent example. Another one would be the recently canceled trip by Congresswoman Talab and Omar. The trip that they had planned to Israel, which they called Palestine, was sponsored by an organization called MIFTA. And MIFTA has previously heralded suicide bombers, and they have claimed that Jews consume Christian blood on Passover. This is an organization that was sponsoring this trip. And this was not noted for all the coverage that was spent on the canceled trip. This is widely ignored by the press. So one thing that we do at Camera is we'll write to editors, we'll write to reporters, requesting corrections, taking them to task when they omit crucial information. And if that fails, we have a massive letter-writing team. So we can do that, get in their inbox, let them know that, look, you guys need to start doing a better job here. You need to report the facts fully. And then if that fails, we'll also do op-eds. So we'll write in various outlets to highlight these issues of media bias, which are endemic when it comes to the conflict.
Do most of the journalists that write falsehoods, because I've been a journalist my entire adult life for more than 50 years, do most of the journalists intend to mislead their readers, or are they misinformed? They don't talk to the right people? What have you found that runs the gamut with how these articles come out?
Great question, Mike. Generally, no. I don't think that most of them do intend to mislead. I think that oftentimes there is this narrative that's already preconceived and packaged, which that Israel is a colonial oppressor, and that it keeps denying Palestinians' rights, and Palestinians don't have a state because of Israel, when in fact, of course, Palestinians have been offered statehood numerous times and rejected it. So I think that there's a prepackaged narrative, and that's part of the problem. And then the other part of the problem is simply that we live in an age in which the media is rapidly changing. It's hard to check one's facts. And there's such a rush to get the story out there that organizations like what we do are increasingly essential, because there is a proliferation of fake news. And I don't think that it's because an intentional effort to mislead, generally speaking. I think it's journalists that are very, very busy. They might not have a deep background and understanding of the conflict, certainly the sort of understanding that we have. And it makes our work really important, in my humble opinion.
Well, I have a follow-up question to that, Sean, because, one of the things that recently came out that you all addressed was CNN. CNN had a report on the 1948-1967 wars, where they literally said, quote, Israeli wars to expand territory. Now, Israel was not the aggressor, was not the attacker. Israel was attacked. In fact, Israel's never been the aggressor attacker. Israel has always been attacked. Those were wars declared by her neighbors against her. And so it's interesting to me that CNN said that. It's dumbfounding to me that somebody could actually say that and not realize that, you know, that was a false narrative. But tell us about that. You know, how hard was it to get the CNN editors to correct that?
Thank you very much for bringing that up. It can be quite difficult at times. Sometimes it totally depends on the editor and the reporter. Sometimes you can get a correction right away. Sometimes it takes a lot of work. That particular instance, I think it took them up to 2 weeks to correct, maybe a little bit less than that.
And by that point, I mean, does it lose its impact? I mean, people already heard the message. Are they going to hear the correction?
Right. That's also a huge problem as well. The story kind of gets out there already. But one thing that we do at Camera to kind of prevent that as best as we can is we have an office in Israel that works with the wire services.
Okay.
And that way they closely monitor things like AP, AFP, Reuters, and they're able to often get corrections immediately. That way it kind of prevents the error from being disseminated to picked up by other newspapers.
Do you go to the reporters? As a reporter, I want to tell you, I hate someone pointing out to me. I mean, I don't hate the person. If I've put something out that was misleading or wrong and I missed it, I would be extremely upset and want to correct it as soon as possible. Do you get pushback from the reporters when you call them and say, wait a second, you're not telling the whole story? Or are they eager to try to set the record straight?
Great question, Mike. Oftentimes they are eager. That's why I really don't think that there's a sort of a malicious intent. And we'll deal with reporters. Sometimes we deal with editors. We build up relationships, and we try and really approach it from the standpoint of, look, nothing's perfect. You guys, journalists, have an extremely difficult job, especially in the Middle East, and we know that. So we're not here to upbraid you or do any of that. We're here to simply let you know that these are the facts. There's something that was left out here, omitted, or that's incorrect. And so here's the proper information, and here's facts that you might not have been aware of.
Yeah, well, like I say, as a reporter, I immediately want to get the right story on the air and get irritated if someone, one of my sources, and I always would check things out, but if one of my sources lied to me or gave me false information, I would be very angry, because it's my reputation as well, if you're putting out something that's incorrect.
That's a great attitude to have, Mike. I do wish that more journalists had that. Quite a few do. But as what we get here sometimes is it's systemic issues. So, for example, it's very common for reporters to quote the Gaza Health Ministry, for example, especially when it came to casualty statistics in the return march or various wars that happened in recent years. Well, the Gaza Health Ministry is run by Hamas, a U.S.-designated terrorist group.
Right.
So what these reporters are doing is they're just uncritically quoting and citing a U.S.-designated terrorist group and promoting its propaganda. And there's been numerous instances where the casualty stats supplied by the Gaza Health Ministry are, of course, incorrect.
I remember watching videos during the 2014 conflict that the Gaza Health Ministry, I believe they were the ones putting it out, where they would literally create like these false scenes of like people being injured and with blood all over them coming into the hospital or whatever. And then, you know, people, there'd be reporters there, that'd be on their cell phones and had their cameras and videotaping the whole thing. And then after the press, quote unquote, left, you then see these people get up and walk away. And it, you know, and it's interesting to me that like that constant reliance upon Hamas in different forms and facets throughout the government without really questioning that. I mean, I think I see this a lot. And so what you're doing in this regard with exposing that, I think is a very important piece to the narrative discussion, the dialogue we need to have. Tell us, what do you see with respect to the reporting? I know you all have, some of your emails have commented a lot about the BBC and in particular, Jeremy Corbyn. What are, you know, and obviously we talk about Jeremy often here on our show. We talk about a lot of the rise of anti-Semitism. What are some of the things you're seeing the press do, whether it's, you know, almost to protect him or not have an open dialogue in anti-Semitism? What are you seeing over there in Europe?
Well, I myself don't deal with Europe. I deal with the Washington Post and other D.C.-based outlets.
Okay.
But I do think that we see similar sorts of problems, very unfortunately. And I got to say, this is a really perilous time for Jewry, not only in America, but throughout the world. And it's incumbent, I think, upon the Fourth Estate, the media, to curb that, present all the facts. And unfortunately, we're not really seeing that. We're seeing a lot of politicization of anti-Semitism, where only anti-Semitic acts are covered from if they can be attributed to, say, the right. And that's a huge problem. CAMERA is a nonpartisan organization. We don't take policy stances. And so that gives us an edge, because we can be seen as neutral when we're trying to highlight issues that are being omitted, miscovered, or misleading. But it's really, really problematic. And we saw this with Talab and Omar with this canceled trip. This is, to me, it's outrageous. You have two members of Congress, two public servants, that are going on a trip that is sponsored by an organization that claims that Jews consume Christian blood. How is that not front page news?
Do you have a problem getting media outlets to cover anti-Semitism that comes from the progressive wing of American politics? When you see the Nazis marching, like in Charlottesville, everybody's all over it. But if it comes from the other side, is there pushback from the media to first to cover it, or then secondly to say, you know, you're right, we missed a point here?
There is absolutely pushback, and it's really been extremely disappointing to see that certain outlets, not every outlet, but some of them just do not want to cover it. They do not want to cover anti-Semitism when it emanates from the progressive left. And our attitude at Camera is we don't care where anti-Semitism comes from. We recognize that it's a violence.
Right, right.
Anti-Semitism is anti-Semitism, right.
It's hate speech, right. No matter what, right.
Exactly.
Interesting.
One other question I have is, are you guys proactive in the sense if someone is working on a story and if you're really immersed in what they're doing, sometimes you hear about this in advance, that you say, okay, I understand you're talking to this group of people about whatever subject it is. You need to also talk to this person or this group. Do you guys get into that, or do you react after the story's been published?
We do get into that. I do think it's important. It's important to be proactive, and so that's part of also our why we try and establish relationships with editors and reporters, because we want them to view us as a source of knowledge and information about the conflict or about larger issues within the Middle East. For example, I've written quite a bit about Palestinian politics, which is a subject that people just don't write about because people want to view Palestinians only through the prism of the conflict or Israel. So Palestinian politics and culture is largely ignored.
Right.
So one thing that I've tried to do is make it so that reporters and editors recognize that I write about this. I have some expertise in this subject. So perhaps, you know, come to us, check out Camera, and, you know, we have some information here that you might not be aware of.
That you're a source that can help broaden out the story so they can tell all ends of the story, which is so important, particularly in right. these times. And you're talking about the Palestinian politics. It's not a monolithic thought in Palestine. And that's I think that's part of the problem with the conflict, is that so many journalists and so many stories look at it as a monolithic thought of the people in Palestine. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, there are significant differences between, say, the Palestinians in Gaza or the Palestinians in the West Bank,
right.
Samaria, in terms of their thinking, their traditions politically. And this is just largely the sort of nuance that you point to, Mike, is often lost when people take these readily adapted narratives. They miss a lot because there's a larger story out there. It's not getting reported.
What can someone do to get in if they see something in whatever media outlet, whether it's on TV, on radio, in print, or online, and they say this is patently false, but as an individual in Tampa, Florida, someone might say, I'm not going to be able to change anything. How do they get in contact with you guys where you can make the difference and be the voice for the voiceless?
That's a fantastic question. So our website, www.camera.org, is a great place for people to go, and you can file complaints about different outlets, bring issues to our attention, and we try and give the power back to the people in the sense that we let them know, okay, we've heard your complaints, this is what we're going to do about it. We'll correspond with those that complain. We have a very active letter writing team. We rely upon support from not only the Jewish community, but anybody that values truth in media. And we help give people the tools for the information on our website to fight back, whether it's writing a letter to the editor, or we can contact the reporter, or what have you. So we really try and be as active and involved and grassroots as possible.
That's terrific. Let me say one thing just from a reporter's standpoint. I always preferred hearing it from the person who was upset, you know, if I erred in a story rather than hearing it from my boss. No, I mean, seriously.
Yes.
And nothing drove me crazier than if I missed something, I'd be angry with myself. But I would want the truth to come out. Now, sometimes I would say, no, you're wrong. I've got it because I research things pretty well. But listen, any journalist that says they have not screwed up or made a story slant a way that shouldn't have been is just not being honest or isn't doing enough stories. But I think going to the reporter is my recommendation to you. I was much more likely to be less defensive if I heard it from someone than if my boss comes in and goes, this person called and said, you know, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. That's from a reporter's standpoint of my suggestion to you guys. But I think what you're doing is just fantastic. And I hope maybe sometime you come back on again, because there's certainly enough false news that is going out throughout the country.
Yeah, and so again, if somebody is interested in participating with CAMRA or following CAMRA, how should they do that?
Definitely go to our website, www.camera.org.
Okay.
And sign up. We send out alerts every week. We have a letter writing team that's extremely active. We also have branches on our campuses to combat growing anti-Semitism there, which are very active.
Yes. Oh, excellent.
So we have all these different methods. We're very active on social media. And so I'd encourage people to check us out.
Okay.
Sounds great.
Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break here and come on back, and we'll take some calls if you want to call us. Our studio line is 813-239-9663. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
Okay, and we're talking about two Jews, three opinions.
So an interesting report did come out this week. I think this is worth talking about because, we've had callers and I think some emails by people who don't understand why Students for Justice in Palestine is a driver of hate on campus and has really made it a difficult place for Jewish students to be on many American campus universities. So there was a report done by the Institute for the Study of Global Anti-Semitism and Policy. It's a 96-page report titled National Students for Justice in Palestine. So that's a national-level organization in the promotion of hate and anti-Semitism on the university campus. And it really sort of dug into what is SJP, because we've talked about it on this show. And so SJP was founded in 2010 at a forum sponsored in part by the BDS National Committee, and is funded by, apparently, there's a point in the report that talks about there's like tons of funding, billions of dollars that comes into the American universities by Muslim Brotherhood and other organizations that really support a lot of the anti-Semitic rhetoric and that conversation that is happening on U.S. campuses. That's made it very uncomfortable for a lot of our students, including the apartheid accusations. And I think they focus a little bit on some of the social media postings by the various SJP chapters. I think one that says, "May Allah not help them and burn them in the hellfire. Let the Jews burn silently," was one of the quotes of one of the chapters about Jews. And then what this report apparently did was take a look at all of this has been going on for almost 10 years now on U.S. campuses through this organization and this constant rhetoric, this constant hate speech towards Jews and towards Israel. And how that actually has had a direct connection to what we've seen is that increase of anti-Semitism on U.S. college campuses, not just on the campus, but also even within school curriculum. So I haven't read the full report. I've read an article on it, but it looks like something that's certainly worth having a closer inspection.
And anti-Semitism on campuses, Columbia University, for example, in New York, is one of the worst places for Jewish students to be. You would think not, because there are a lot of Jewish students at Columbia University, but that is one of the universities that's been identified as being a tough place for
Jews to be
precisely because of this movement on college campuses.
Right. And so I think this is, but I think it's an important part of the dialogue that people understand really what that organization is about, that it really is a direct connection to the BDS movement. And it's an ideology movement. It's really about, again, what we talked about before, rewriting the narrative. I mean, calling Israel an apartheid state. I mean, the last time I checked, it's against the law for any Palestinian to sell land to a Jew. In fact, in Hebron last year, both a father and a son were murdered by the government for selling, for having the audacity to sell a piece of property to a Jew. And so it's, you know, that's where the, you know, you don't talk about that. You want to call Israel an apartheid state, which we've had so many dialogues on the station about the fact that it's not apartheid. And anybody who goes there can see the amazing diverse communities and that even the Arab Israelis, you know, are proud of being Arab Israelis, are proud of their
country.
We've
had some on the air with us, absolutely.
And so it's an ideology war. What they're trying to do is take these young students and ingrain them with this false narrative that they've been doing in the media for 20, 30, 40 plus years now, and try to capture their minds at a younger age. And that's really, it's an ideology war. And we have to be much more aggressive in speaking out against these things when we see it in these false claims. But of course, and we've had this in the Forward this week, the Forward magazine. There's a piece of, again, some attacks at UCF. Earlier this month, didn't we have some caller who said, you know, there were no anti-Semitism attacks
at UCF? Oh, yeah, the UCF. Yeah,
right.
No, there was a whole article about that this week.
And by the way, at the UCF Chabad House, was defaced with posters that included swastikas earlier this month as well. But these attacks are real.
This is right in our own backyard.
Right.
Listen, we've got a lot of callers on the line waiting, so let's go to one of our regulars who has been waiting
Simon.
For a bit. Simon, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the points that the gentleman from Camera didn't discuss, which is really the pretext of the organization, is what they do is they actually, Arab leaders will speak in two tongues, if you will. Arafat used to speak to the Western audience, and then when he spoke to his own people, he would speak in a different tone of peace. And so what Camera does is they find speeches of Arab leaders, and they translate what is said into English. And so that is the essence of what they do that's very good. The other thing I wanted to bring to light, which is what this goes back to 2002. On this own station, Francis Boyle, who's a professor, University of Illinois, was interviewed by Rob Lori. And I sent Francis Boyle a response to what he said. And this goes back a little bit. But what Francis Boyle said was that he quoted Sharon saying that the Jews control American foreign policy. And what Camera did back in 2002, they found the source of that misfact, and it went to the Chicago Tribune by the author of George Annie Geyer, and she never had direct knowledge of that quote. She got that quote from the Islamic Association for Palestine. So what happens is, as a journalist, if you want to go into the Arab countries, the Muslim countries, you have to be very nice to them with regard to what the narrative will be, or you will not get exposure. That happened to Nick Robertson when he went into Lebanon during the Hezbollah war with Israel, and he was paraded around for CNN coverage as to the sites they wanted him to go to.
Well, but Simon, it's sloppy journalism to take a quote from a third party and then not track it down to see if there's any veracity to that. That's shameful.
Right, and I think it goes a little more to even what Sean was commenting on. I think what we've commented on a lot is, like, people go in with their preconceived notions of the conflict, and is that ideology. So if you're going in with that preconceived ideology, that these mindsets, you're not going to question it. Someone tells you, oh, so-and-so said this. So let's say you have that anti-Semitic ideology where, you know, Jews control the world, and all of a sudden someone says Sharon said that. You're like, great, that supports everything I believe in. Boom.
Right.
And you write it down, and I think that's what an organization like Camera does. I think that's a, you know, very important point. And getting people to sort of say, you know, step back and look again. And as I've always said, if you hate one side in the conflict, you will never see clearly. If you don't have love for humanity and love for both sides, then you will never, never be able to look at something with truth and truly, sincerely question yourself and look at, like, what is happening here and how can we resolve these issues?
We've got a lot of calls. 813-239-9663 is our number. And Peter in Lakeland, you're on the air.
Hey, hello there. Thanks for having this topic. I'm a bit confused, and you're from the media side. Is there anybody on CNN, MSNBC, NBC, Fox, or ABC in the news that ever covers Israel with a critical look at the policies? And the answer is... really, no.
Oh, that's not true.
I would say, you know, if you're talking about a critical look at the policies, if you're just talking about Israel, you're talking about the Palestinian Authority. I think Israel is regularly criticized, and what happens is that, and I you see this often. And so, to answer your question, Peter, I will say this. I see this often. I see where you will see 2-minute clips or 3-minute clips of something, and then they go on. And this is a very complex, long-suffering issue that can never be addressed in a 2 or 3 minute clip. So in that sense of saying, is there anyone ever having long... No, I would agree with you.
But no, when Netanyahu was talking about that if he was reelected, he was going to claim the territories back, I saw tremendous critical analysis on all spectrums from MSNBC to Fox about how this was a mistake from various reporters, not all reporters, and not... all commentators. And the problem is with all the cable news outlets, you have to separate the commentators from the reporters. There's a huge difference between Sean Hannity and Chris Wallace.
I agree what you're saying, but I mean, you don't see people coming on being critical of Israel. At least you never see them twice.
Oh, well, I
well, but no.
I would disagree with that. I think most of the media I see on Israel is actually really critical. I see a lot of, and I see a very one-sided, whether we're in conflicts or different places. But I never see criticism. To your point, I've never seen criticism of the Palestinian Authority or Hamas on how they treat their people.
Can I give you an example?
Do a quick one because we got lots of calls. Yeah, please do.
When the Palestinians, just a few months ago, were protesting, there was Israeli snipers shooting them. There was a guy in a wheelchair with no leg who got a center shot from a sniper. Now, that film footage was shown in Europe, but it was never shown in the U.S. Now, why is that?
I don't know. However, how about the criticism of Hamas utilizing elderly, utilizing handicap, and bringing children to a conflict zone when Hamas's intent, because there are terrorists there, because Hamas's intent is to attack. Hamas is engaging in violent attacks on that border.
So
that person who was an innocent victim, by the way, and I would agree if they're not part of that conflict, but there's somebody who was there because Hamas made them come. Just as how Hamas is manipulating and using children and elderly as human shields, that should be part of the dialogue. We should be having a conversation about that. I completely agree.
Ma'am, they were shooting medics.
Well,
all right, that's a different conversation. And that's
okay, listen,
not an accurate
we'll have to do that
we'll
another time,
that
Peter. We got a lot of calls waiting. Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. We've got David from San Francisco on the air. David?
Well, yeah, I wanted to make a point that was... about how we're being played. The various religions are being played. I'm Irish, basically, right? And Northern Ireland fighting Southern Ireland, what's that all about? Well, it was because the colonists, the British, owned a big chunk of Ireland, and they were playing the Catholics against the Protestants. But really, it was whether or not a big chunk of Ireland was owned as a colony by an island right next door. And so Palestine, I mean, you look at Gaza, or yeah, the Golan Heights, Dick Cheney being given the fracking rights to the Golan Heights, and his business plan is to run a pipeline straight up to Turkey, and whoops, it just right happens to go right through Syria where ISIS begins. So ISIS is there to basically cut the swathe so that the pipeline of Dick Cheney can get to the Nabucco pipeline. And
well, I don't believe that's why ISIS is there at that border. But go on. That, I think that's your opinion, but I don't
it's
actually.
An oil,
there's
private army. I'm a private army of an oil company, but an oil company with Woolsey of the CIA, Rupert Murdoch. Look at the Strategic Advisory Group as a part of Genie Oil Gas. Genie Oil Gas sold the fracking rights by Netanyahu in 2014. And it's all about the fracking and pipelines across Syria. And don't pretend that it's anything about religion. And anybody that's siding with
are
going to come out wrong.
Well, no.
Hold on, David. You're okay. So first of all, the Sunnis and the Shias have been fighting each other since approximately 700 Common Era. Then you have, and it is, by the way, a lot about religion. So thank you for opening the door for me to have that conversation, because this is really important. You know, Jews lived throughout the Middle East, Northern Africa, the Balkan states, the Ottoman Turks. They have lived throughout that whole region. They have lived in the land that was renamed in 130 Common Era by Rome. The Judea and Samaria was renamed by them Palestine. They have lived in Palestine. In fact, there are more Jews living in Jerusalem than Arabs or Muslims or anyone else, you know, 100 years before there was even a Jewish, modern-day Jewish state. But the Jews that were living in these countries were considered second-class and third-class citizens under Sharia law. So in the early 1900s, the Grand Mufti in Jerusalem, who really helped found the Muslim Brotherhood and who worked very closely with Hitler, you began to see pogroms and revolts. And ultimately, the Jews that were living in these countries were kicked out with nothing but their shirts on their back. Jews who had communities, these are communities that lasted thousands of years, sometimes, you know, back to, you know, the Second Temple times, and hundreds of years in other situations, being thrown out. They become into Israel as refugees. Why? Because they're Jews, because they weren't Muslims. So religion has a lot to do with it, and it also has a lot to do with the mindset. You understand this current hatred that was started in the early 1930s with the Muslim Brotherhood. It was because the idea, like, the audacity of a Jew to think that they could have self-rule, that they could have their own country when they have been second and third class citizens for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Now they think that they're going to have a government and they're going to have self-rule. It is part of that mindset and that dialogue. So religion has a lot. It's the manipulation, let me be clear about this, the manipulation of religion has a lot to do with it in that particular region.
Okay, we have time to take one more call, one of our regular callers who disagrees with about everything we say. Clay, you're on the air. We've got a short amount of time, so make your point quickly, please.
Shalom. I will first want to say I agree with the last two callers. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
But I like the bottom line things. You know, and the bottom line to this, despite all the other things, I can't wait to get to the internet and look at the veracity of some of the things you had earlier on your show and how accurate and truthful they are. Because I question.
No, we were just making it up, Clayton.
It's all fake news. It's all fake news, Mike.
Fox News and you have something in common. So, but let's not go there.
All right, Clay, we got a minute.
Yeah, you got to just make your thought, Clay.
Let me bottom line it.
Okay, go ahead.
There is the issue that under international law, under all the resolutions passed by the UN and everything, Israel is taken and occupying territories with settlements. They have moved people into places unable to.
Okay, Clay. Let me.
And Jews also live there.
Please finish, and then you guys can ramble on afterwards.
Oh, Clay. Wait,
no, but wait. You said something about the UN. Wait, Clay.
Legal settlement.
Clay. Don't yell. Don't yell, Clay.
They're not illegal under Atlanta.
Wait, Clay. The UN is so prejudiced against Israel. It is the only country they condemn on a regular basis. All the other countries with dictatorships and where they kill people who oppose the government, the UN turns a blind eye, and only Israel is the one that's at fault, according to the UN. It just cannot be.
Right. And I just add, Clay, so thank you for calling and your comments. You know, by the way, pre-1948, Jews had lived in Judea, Samaria for hundreds of years. There have been Jewish communities in Israel consistently. In Israel for thousands of years, we never left, even after the Roman rule. Although Rome did kick and kill all Jews in Jerusalem, as did the Crusaders, okay. But the Jews always came back.
So, and we got to go. I'm Mike Thiessen.
That's
tell them who you are.
Lorene Jaffe. Thank
you.
All right, there we go.
You're listening to WMNF Tampa. This is the Sunday Simcha. I'm Joy Katzen-Guthrie, and welcome to our tribute show this November 3rd, 2019, to Fiddler on the Roof, which has been performed in 104 nations. Here are a few of them.
¿Por qué nos mantenemos aquí si es tan peligroso? La respuesta la puedo dar enseguida. Nos mantenemos aquí porque Anatevka es nuestro hogar. ¿Y cómo mantenemos el equilibrio? Esto puedo contestarlo con una sola palabra. ¡Tradición!